This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hello, Wall. Hello, Place to Be Nation. Hello, hello. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And as you can probably tell, we are coming to you live this week from the I-shaped studios.
Oh, man.
In a different wing of Ho-Ho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. He is Nick Duke.
We're currently dealing with a Trojan situation, but that's neither here nor there.
And we're not talking about your Troy Trojans, the hottest football program outside of the Power Five in college football.
Oh, yeah. No, we're not talking about the esteemed Troy Trojans from Troy, New York.
We've been to Deimos. Nonetheless, I am Greg Phillips. He is Nick Duke. And we are here to talk to you a little bit about X-Men Month, Nick. This is our second installment.
Yes. In X-Men Month. Yes, it is. And it's appropriate because, you know, last week we brought you a very special countdown of our top, you know, our full ranking of the Fox X-Men films, 1 to 11. And I guess it's time to update those rankings because the latest and final installment in the X-Universe over at Fox.
Except for possibly New Mutants.
Yeah, but will that count? I mean, because, you know, the reshoot, I don't know. Anyway, the point is, I don't think we're going to re-rank them if New Mutants does wind up coming out. So, final installment of the Fox X-Verse for now, at least, as Dark Phoenix has hit the box office. It is now showing, for the time being anyway, at your local multiplex. So, run out and catch it if you dare.
And you may not be able to catch it for very long.
Yes.
Because it does not appear, as of this recording,
no,
which is done on the Saturday of opening weekend. Mm-hmm. It does not appear to be doing what I've been told is called good business.
Yeah, so apparently two months ago, it was projecting somewhere in the $60 to $70 million range, which is kind of would have been a fairly an average-sized opening for a superhero film with this kind of budget. Mm-hmm. And in recent weeks, those projections have kind of trended downward. And so coming into the weekend, it was projected to finish somewhere between 40 and 50 million. And as of today, those projections have been lowered all the way down to 37 million now. This will be the worst box office opening in the franchise's history.
Indeed so. Indeed so. And so this film is, of course, Dark Phoenix by first-time director Simon Kinberg, longtime X-Men writer Simon Kinberg. Who's pretty much been involved in the franchise from its inception, I believe, or at least since the early days of the franchise, X2 and all that stuff, has kind of shepherded the franchise in recent years, with Bryan Singer taking on less and less of a role as the years have rolled on. This is the sequel of sorts to X-Men Apocalypse.
I would definitely say it's a sequel. I mean, it continues that story directly. Yeah.
A new team of X-Men that was introduced there with a new Cyclops, a new Jean Grey, a new Nightcrawler, and Storm.
And then you've also got Mystique and Beast now being portrayed as kind of the elder statesmen of the X-Men.
Leftovers from First Class.
Right, but that team was set up at the end of Apocalypse. I believe, wasn't the closing shot of Apocalypse,
them in the
danger room?
And they donned their X-Men costumes.
Yeah, the blue and the yellow X-Men costume. Mm-hmm. So we knew after Apocalypse that a X-Men follow-up was coming. We assumed, I think, a lot of us, based on Jean Grey's role in that in the finale, you know, the final action sequence of that film, that it might be a Phoenix story of some sort. We didn't necessarily know it was going to be Dark Phoenix, but they confirmed that pretty quickly after, that they're doing Dark Phoenix again. And it's interesting, you mentioned Simon Kinberg getting to write and direct here. He was one of the writers on the last time they tried this, on X-Men Last Stand. And it's spoken about his desire to see them right the wrongs of that movie, to get Dark Phoenix and do it right. I suppose we can debate whether or not he achieved that goal.
Indeed. So, we are not going to take you beat by beat through the movie. We're not going to try to spoil the plot for you necessarily. But what we are going to do is give you our unabashed thoughts on the film.
Yeah, there may be some incidental spoilers here throughout. So, I mean, if you haven't seen the film and you want to stay completely spoiler-free, then you might want to just skip this podcast. I don't know.
Or jump to the second half.
Tell
you all about what we've been reading.
We're not going to go out of our way to avoid discussion points if they come up. But we're not, like Greg said, we're not going to go beat by beat through the movie either, I don't think.
No, we don't have the beat. We're not the Go-Go's, despite popular internet rumor and hearsay to the contrary.
Oh, we got the beat.
And if we were the Go-Go's, I would clearly be the Belinda Carlisle of the group. She was the lead singer, Nick. She was a big star back in the 80s. Anyway,
if she's not an Oak Ridge boy, I don't have a damn clue who she is.
What about Farron Young? We were just talking about the great
Farron
Young.
Farron Young, yeah.
He killed himself, you know. Shot himself with a shotgun, yep. In the 90s.
His brain was all over the hella walls.
Oh, God. Good Lord, man. What a Farron Young... I don't know. Hey, but back to less grimy, dirty topics. And let's talk about the seedy underbelly of Dark Phoenix. So, as we mentioned, the cast from First Class is pretty much back here. Fassbender as Magneto.
What I would call the core cast of First Class. Because we talked about last week on last week's episode, First Class, you wind up caring about Beast, you wind up caring about Mystique, you care about Xavier, you care about Magneto. And then there may be some lesser characters. I remember Banshee, Havoc, we talked about Darwin, we talked about Angel, we have no clue. I mean, we're really, those are the four that are kind of important and have carried through this is the third follow-up to First Class now. They've done four with this cast, which is crazy.
One of them was genuinely great.
Was, yes. I stand by that.
Yes. But this movie was not great. I will start us out, I suppose, with just saying that this movie has been savaged by the critics at this point. Fair to say, the second lowest rated on Metacritic of all the X-Men movies.
Yeah, and I think the lowest on Rotten Tomatoes.
I don't think it's that bad.
I would mostly agree with that. Now, Rotten Tomatoes isn't a very good.
It's a weird metric.
So, like, if we're talking about it, you go to Rotten Tomatoes and you read some of the reviews, and people may write stuff like, it's not, they'll just say things like, it's not a train wreck, it's just boring. Which I think the movie is, honestly. But, and that counts as a negative review, which it should. Metacritic kind of tries to attach a numerical value to a review to give you a more, because there are zero reviews than there are, 50 reviews. In terms of that 1 to 100 scale. I think the Metacritic score on this one's more accurate. I can say safely, for me after watching this, it's at least in the bottom three. And we'll discuss next week, I think, whether or not it's a bottom two.
When we came out of theater, I think I liked it more than Nick did.
Yes.
Which is not too surprising.
No, because I liked
Apocalypse more than Nick did.
But I liked Days of Future Past more than you did.
True.
So that's...
I probably liked First Class a little bit more, though we're pretty close on that one.
Yeah.
We've
generally been pretty close on
most of
the X-Men movies in general. I think you're higher on Origins than I am. Yeah, no, you tried to defend it. Yeah, but you've had a lot more defense of it,
There are things that I like in it, yeah. There are things in all of these movies that I like.
I would agree with that, yeah.
They've not made one that had nothing in it that I liked at all.
And I think that continues here. There are enough things, I won't say enough things, you can watch this movie and you will find something that you will like in it. Now, does it all hold together for a greater narrative? Does it all serve a larger purpose? Not really.
Does it have what the French call a certain...
I don't know. So where should we start here?
Well, I guess we can't do the direct comparison until next week.
Yeah, we're going to directly... So next week we're going to be rewatching Last Stand for Off the Page and kind of...
We'll be able to have more of a one-to-one comparison.
We're going
to
settle that debate. Simon Kinberg said, hey, we want to... we want to fix what we did wrong on Last Stand, and we can kind of tell you. We'll give you more of an informed opinion on that next week.
So, right out of the gates, one of the things that felt like it didn't get fixed, that felt like it was a common mistake in the series, was the inability, for whatever reason, to truly balance the ensemble cast.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
It's something that we've marveled at, no pun intended. Okay, a lot of pun intended, in the MCU.
Right.
And it's something that the X-Men movies have largely struggled with. Usually there's one, two, maybe three interesting characters that you really focus in on, and the rest of the cast is kind of underserved.
Right.
And that, to me, proves out to be the case here again. This is less an X-Men movie than it is a Jean Grey movie.
Which, you know, there are some defenses to be made of that mm-hmm. particular approach. But I think mm-hmm. the problem is, you go back to 2005 and you watch Last Stand and they fail in the ensemble aspect of it. And you kind of go, all right, whatever. Because a true superhero ensemble in 2005 didn't exist. No, we didn't have one yet.
We didn't know how you could possibly do it.
Really. And now we kind of we've seen how it can be done and done to great effect.
Mm-hmm.
And you always hesitate to just say everybody should follow the Marvel formula and make their movies just like the MCU. But it is a proof case for you can do a superhero ensemble movie and make sure everybody gets a moment. And I would argue in this film you don't get that.
No, I think there are several characters that do get moments, mm-hmm. but there are some that get few to none. And some of them are the same characters that have been underserved since the outset of the X-Men universe. Cyclops,
Storm.
Storm. These are characters who have historically been underserved in these movies. And that kind of proves to be the case here, too. Because really, whereas you would think that a Dark Phoenix adaptation would kind of focus on Scott, Jean, number one, and her relationships with Scott and Xavier and the rest of the team in that order.
Mm-hmm.
In this movie, it's really Jean and her relationship with Xavier.
The entire time, yeah.
You know, we get some stuff with her and Scott, and he certainly plays a role in the movie. But
he doesn't really play a role other than concerned boyfriend, though.
Yeah, he's angry and he's upset, which is fine. That's his role in the story, honestly. But
okay, go ahead.
And leader of the X-Men, obviously, which he's not here.
No, Mystique is.
Right. But the interesting thing is that Nick pointed this out also when we left the theater, that there isn't it's hard to do the Dark Phoenix if you haven't built to it. If
right.
you haven't earned it and grown attached to these characters. We just got introduced to Scott and Jean in this iteration in X-Men Apocalypse, where they were not the centerpiece characters. I thought they were. If you go back and listen to our review of X-Men Apocalypse, or read our review, whatever we did with it.
I think we did a podcast.
I think we did too. And if you listen to that, I was very high on the new Jean Grey, Sophie Turner, and the new Cyclops, that guy.
Ty Sheridan.
And I was high on them. I thought they did a great job in the movie, but they didn't. They were not centerpieces. They were
right.
small parts of an ensemble movie.
They were being introduced
to
set up the future, but the core of that movie was going to be, if I remember correctly, you had Beast, you had Mystique, you had Xavier, Magneto, and then you had whoever he picked as his horseman. So Storm mm-hmm. actually got more screen time on Apocalypse than than Scott or Jean
got
did.
An story.
Angel, Nightcrawler. Mm-hmm. I mean, the point being, Scott and Jean were just introduced to us in Apocalypse. They weren't a major focus until the end when they used Jean as like this magic get out of jail free card. And I had complaints about that at the time, if you remember, like. Having Jean showcase Phoenix-level powers to basically single-handedly defeat Apocalypse in her first appearance
to set up the sequel
was
right.
very frustrating to me.
They did not. Dark Phoenix is a story that they need to work towards. They need to earn. They need to spend years building. The reason it works in the comics is because you've grown attached to Jean Grey. You've grown attached to Scott Summers and their love story.
Mm-hmm.
Their connection to one another.
And also, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm far from an X-Men expert, but isn't part of the Dark Phoenix story is, I think Tim pointed this out in the chat earlier, not only have you gotten attached to Jean Grey, you've had to feel for her as she has come to deal with this massive change, as she's become Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think she has it all together, and that's when it all falls apart. And so, like, it always seems like they skip the Phoenix part of this in the movies and go straight to the Dark Phoenix stuff.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that isn't part of the problem.
Absolutely.
That Phoenix segment is integral in some regards.
It is. And the manipulation aspect is always kind of poorly done in these movies, both in Last Stand and in this one.
So in Last Stand, you have Magneto kind of serving as the master manipulator.
Which never really made a lot
of sense. And here you have a character called Vuk.
Yes. Actually, she's part of a pair of Japanese twins, you may know. Yes. Vuk you and Vuk me.
And we apologize this moment if you can hear Herschel the Wonder Dog snoring loudly in the background.
Yeah, he's...
we're doing the best we can.
He's living his best life.
Absolutely. But the point is, here you have this alien character, Vuk.
No, I can't hear anything else.
And so, Greg, I don't know anything about X-Men cosmic stories for the most part. So, like, you know, we all had heard the rumors or knew that Jessica Chastain was in the movie. We knew there was some kind of alien presence. So I think even me as a novice X-Men fan kind of was going, okay, she's got to be playing one of the Shi'ar, right? Because my understanding of the Phoenix story is that the Shi'ar have typically played a role, right?
Well, it's funny you should say that because my understanding of that is primarily based on the X-Men cartoon. And so, yes, my understanding is that the Shi'ar have always been involved in the story when I've encountered it. So, you got your Princess Lalandra, which is who I thought Jessica Chastain was playing once this casting came out and everything.
And probably should have been, for the record.
So I thought we were going to get the whole deal with Lalandra and the Starjammers and all that stuff. Well, the one thing that I will say, again, I don't want to spoil this movie for you, but if you're going in with the expectation of seeing the Starjammers or the Macron crystal or the Mcron crystal, whatever you want to call it, or Lalandra or Gladiator or any of those folks, they don't have that here. They do have a brief space story at the very beginning, and they involve this alien race that I've never heard of from... apparently they do exist, and they are the asparagus people.
Yes.
And I have never heard of them before. Never encountered them.
No.
Don't know who they are.
But apparently, according to this, they first appeared in The Avengers Volume 1, number 4 of 1964. Did not even know I've read that, but I have. And so this whole bit about they are a people who the Phoenix Force destroys their homeworld.
Yeah.
And that's what that happens to them in the comics. Here in the movie, same thing, but they come to Earth to seek out the Phoenix Force because they believe they can destroy it or perhaps
control it
into creating themselves a new homeworld.
Yes, which would be Earth in this case.
Yes. That isn't revealed until late in the movie after we show it. But fuck it.
I mean, it's not that big a shock either. So,
no.
Yeah, and the reason it's not a shock is because Jessica Chastain, a very talented actress, portrays this character of Vuk. But here's the deal with Vuk. Vuk is a, or I'm assuming we're pronouncing that right.
Vuk.
I'm
going to assume it's Vuk based on that.
Who gives a fuck?
Based on the alternate pronunciation alone.
So this character, because it's this weird alien shapeshifter kind of deal, is portrayed as not having any emotion at all, very stoic.
It's essentially a Skrull. An alien with the powers of a Skrull, but made to look like one of the zombies from I Am Legend.
Yes, very, very accurate, which is not a compliment.
No, it's really bad. Whenever these characters are seen in their alien form, it's some bad CGI.
So, and she, this is a very talented actress that they are really wasting here because she doesn't get to emote at all. I mean, they could have saved so much money on this budget. Instead of paying Jessica Chastain her millions of dollars, they could have signed literally anyone to play this role.
Or signed a variety of people. Like, just get a different bit player to play them in every scene because the idea is that they're a shapeshifter. So, like, just have them jump bodies the entire time instead of getting Jessica Chastain.
Right. At least then you get some kind of a sort of body horror element to it.
My biggest issue with the Jessica Chastain character in this movie, we meet her at this scene in her human form, and she already just looks like no human being would look. Like, she's like got pale eyebrows that are whited out and like white blonde hair and dressed in all white. She looks like an alien from the jump. Who is this strange person?
She looks like a member of the Targaryen family from Game of Thrones.
Yeah, not dissimilar, yeah.
So, in any event, that's an issue from the get-go because you're wasting this character. You don't get any of the kind of joyful space pirating crap that you get from the comics, or at least from the cartoon, I should say, which is my main base on this story. So that's a disappointment in a lot of ways. And they kind of, again, they skip from point A to point C because we really need to have that attachment. I think less importantly for Jean, because this is very, as I said from the get-go, this is a Jean Grey movie.
Right.
And in my opinion, this movie does a really good job of telling Jean Grey's story and getting, I was invested in Jean by the end of this movie.
Like, I was too.
I cared about her. I wanted her to make it out of it okay, even though I knew she wouldn't. And the problem is you need to care about the other X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't gotten me there with Cyclops. They hadn't gotten me there with Nightcrawler, with Storm, with Beast, with all these other characters that have these emotions entangled. I cared about Jean. I cared about Xavier and Magneto.
Mystique.
And Mystique. And the rest of the gang is kind of, you know, they're underdeveloped, I should say. It's not the fault. The actors are all really good in this.
It goes back to the, you know, we just talked about it a little while ago. They chose to, so by the end of Apocalypse, correct me if I'm wrong, but are Scott and Jean even a couple by the end of Apocalypse?
Yeah.
But, like, it's very, like, they have just recognized this mutual attraction and are going with it, right?
Yeah, and are pursuing it.
And
yeah.
So this movie, it tells us, picks up in 1982, and if I remember correctly. 1992. And Apocalypse, if I remember correctly, takes place in 1985, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I don't remember.
So let's say 7 years in between, and we've got 7 years of Scott and Jean together that all happens off-screen.
Right.
Which is fine. These movies are doing time jumps. There has to be some off-screen development. The problem is the entirety, virtually the entirety of this Scott and Jean relationship has happened off-screen. Mm. And as a result, we're not invested in this relationship, or I wasn't at least. And as a result of that, because Scott's only purpose in this movie is to be the concerned boyfriend, because his only reason for existence is to care about Jean, and I haven't seen the development of that caring, I wind up not caring about Cyclops in this movie.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. That's quite fair. So I think the acting is really good in this, as it is in most of the X-Men movies. Like,
is Jessica Chastain good in this movie?
No. I'm saying, but it's. Jessica Chastain isn't bad either. Jessica Chastain does
has shit material
with a character that requires you to show no emotion, nothing interesting to say.
Now, Greg, some people would say the same could be said for January Jones as Emma Frost.
Oh God, in X-Men First Class. Some people, there's a different even in this. There's a difference in Jessica Chastain and January Jones. One of them knows what the hell she's doing on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is a black hole of charisma. The other one has the same level of charisma as Jim Cornette's NWA in the 1998 WWF.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, you're right. The performances are mostly good. It's largely an issue of real estate and script.
Yeah.
So, Alexandra Shipp as Storm, for example, I feel like there's a path to getting me there with that character that they just have chosen not to take because she was mind controlled for the entirety of Apocalypse.
Yes.
and gets like what? Like if she gets 20 lines of dialogue in this movie, I'd be surprised.
She's our Hawkeye, mind controlled for an entire movie. And then
nothing.
And then properly developed him the rest of the series.
Yeah.
She doesn't get anything here really. She gets one cool moment of getting to unleash her lightning powers on the train sequence near the end of the movie. Spoiler alert for that as well, but it's a cool scene. But other than that, and she gets to, I guess she makes it cold at some point, but...
Yeah, she uses her weather powers to seal the hull of a spaceship in space where there is no atmosphere.
Yes, and she uses it to blow some aliens out the back of the train or whatever to save Magneto.
That was
kind of
cool.
Yeah. So we'll get to that in a minute, but... I think the acting is good across the board here with what they have. You know, Fassbender's amazing. I mean, Fassbender has been, to me, largely the MVP of this series. Lawrence is good as Mystique, as usual.
I'm going to actually...
McAvoy's...
I'm going to make a case for McAvoy now at this point. Because Fassbender dominated, you know, First Class. He was so great. And kind of dominated Apocalypse. And I feel like... Now, they're kind of neck and neck between, because we talked last week about how much I love Xavier in Days of Future Past.
Yes.
This movie gives Charles Xavier far more to do than it does Magneto.
Much more nuance to it.
Yeah.
This time
and
it's interesting, the character developments, because that's, in a lot of ways, where we talked about the lack of development for all the other X-Men, one of the things I did like about this movie was the growth that we've seen in Magneto and Xavier.
Yes.
In different directions. So Magneto has actually gotten to a point where he is a little bit at peace with himself.
Yeah.
He's realized the error of his ways.
And he's kind of building something he believes.
Building something peacefully that he believes can serve both humans and mutants moving forward. Xavier, on the other hand, in the wake of all of the successes that we've seen in the prior movies, has kind of parlayed that into a celebrity status and into this role perceived as the savior of the masses. And he's kind of relishing this.
Yes, he is. He is drinking his own Kool-Aid at this
point.
Yes,
there's an element, and McAvoy brilliantly straddles that line of never making you think that Charles has completely lost his humanity because
right.
he still cares about these kids, but it's clear Charles also cares about Charles.
He's lost sight of, like, the true meaning behind what he was doing all along. Tim, who's going to be listening, said in the chat that he's not a big fan of villainizing Charles Xavier. And I can see why one would say they villainized him in this movie. But I kind of like this take of, like, Patrick Stewart played the idealized Charles Xavier perfectly. James McAvoy is given so much more to do with Charles Xavier over the course of four movies than Patrick Stewart ever was, except for Logan, of course, which stands
Logan's
alone.
Yeah.
And I kind of like, I mean, I and like this taking this character to different places, and it doesn't feel out of character.
This didn't feel to me as extreme as what Marvel Comics has done with Xavier in the last 25, 30 years, where in the comics, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, you've read more recently Marvel Universe stuff than I have, but Xavier was pretty well villainized by the time he got wiped off the planet in that Phoenix story they did a few years ago.
Wasn't that Avengers versus X-Men?
I think so, yeah.
Where Scott had the Phoenix Force.
That's right, yep. But, yeah, they've really done a lot of weird stuff with Xavier. But I'm like you, Nick. I mean, I've never been a fan of the comics of villainizing Xavier, but I kind of accepted that that's the direction that Marvel chose to go in for whatever reason. So I kind of like the fact that they give him nuance here. They give him flaws. In other words, he's not the kindly, flawless professor that we've expected from Patrick Stewart for so many years. But I like the way that he portrayed it here. And Fassbender was great doing this sort of evolving Magneto that kind of evolves into more of, I think, perhaps how Chris Claremont viewed him versus the one-dimensional at times villain that we know from the past movies. So I like all of them. Jean, I thought, was played by Sophie Turner. And I know, Nick, you said you thought her performance was a little up and down in the movie. I liked Turner in this one. I haven't seen her in much else. But
I mean, I think the problem is largely, again, to go back to the material. The performances, like we've said, are mostly good. But there are times where there's only so much they can do with it. Because I think this really does have one of the worst scripts of any X-Men movie. Ultra-obvious lines, kind of eye-rolly stuff at various points in the movie. Sophie Turner having to say the line, "No, my emotions make me strong," as like the big climactic thing. Like, just stuff like that where I felt like McAvoy or Fassbender could take lines that weren't that great and kind of elevate them, and I didn't think she quite did that. The stuff that was better written for her, she was great. I'm not criticizing her performance at all, though. I thought she was pretty good.
Well, the one of the other aspects, talking about the script, I think there are scenes that are incredibly well written here, and I think there are scenes that are incredibly badly written here.
Yes.
And in particular, because I have to be fair here, because I called out Captain Marvel for this, the attempts at humor in this movie largely missed with me.
Were there any?
No, there were. There were lines, I think, that were supposed to be funny.
I didn't even realize that.
There were Nightcrawler.
This is probably the most humorless X-Men film, I would say.
I would 100% agree with that. It is, you know, I hesitate to use the stupid line,
joyless,
because it's a dumb thing that doesn't mean anything. But I think it is certainly a humorless film. But I think there are lines that are intended to be funny that just aren't. I think the only guy that succeeds at that in the entire movie is Quicksilver.
Who's
painfully underutilized in this. We didn't even talk about him at the beginning of
the show. God almighty.
Evan Peters, whose Quicksilver was one of the stars of Days of Future Past. had less to do in X-Men Apocalypse.
No, he had more to do in Apocalypse because he was part of the team.
Oh, that's right. But it has much less to
do. By the end of Apocalypse, they're giving you that promise of he's going to be a featured member of the X-Men going forward. Not the case.
No pickup of the thread with him and Magneto from Apocalypse either, which they made a thing.
God.
So there's no pickup of that. He only gets stuff to do in the opening scene of the movie, the space bit. He's great.
And then he
gets one of the few funny bits in the movie where he's kind of taking credit for the entire mission, essentially. Right. So yeah, he had that one good bit and is underutilized the rest of the entire movie. But yeah, other than that, the attempts at humor are so flat. They're jokes that aren't jokes, you know, and they're one-liners that are supposed to be funny. They're not. And
Nightcrawler was pretty good in terms of the humor. Yeah. There's somebody asked him a question at some point.
Oh yeah,
I don't even remember what the question was. He just goes, "No."
Yeah, are you okay? It's Xavier. He goes, "Kurt, are you okay?" No. So it's the most humorless X-Men movie for sure to this point. And
Jackman, I wouldn't have a problem
so
with
much
that.
To some of the other ones,
I wouldn't have a problem with that if the drama they were trying to build was effective. You know, like if there were something else in the story to take its place.
For me, in bits, it is effective because I did become invested in Jean's story, and I did become particularly the stuff with her and her dad was good, I thought.
That was good, I agree.
And the stuff with her confronting Xavier and calling him on his BS was good. But really, the
general outline of this movie is not the problem. I think the script is the problem. I think the pacing is definitely the problem.
Yeah.
That's one thing I told Greg after we saw it. I've seen Avengers Endgame 4 or 5 times. At 3-hour runtime, plus credits, never felt a single second of that movie.
That's the one area where I think you can tell the difference from Bryan Singer to
Simon Kinberg.
Now, Singer's been dealing with his own issues in recent years, but both directorially and otherwise. But I think Apocalypse was a slow-moving Bryan Singer movie, but we saw with his X-Men movies in particular, Days of Future Past, X2, X-Men, he knows how to cut a pace in his movies. He knows how to cut a pace, knows how to make the movie roll along, you know, in a way that the audience doesn't feel the length of it so much, or the girth for that matter. And in this one, yeah, you're right. The pacing...
Because it's only, 2 hours and 10 minutes?
No, it's not a long movie at all.
Right, but you feel it.
Yeah, it's... And that's kind of an intuitive thing, and I think that's because Kinberg has never directed a film to this point.
And he also he comes from a writing background, yes. So I think probably he kind of fell in love with his own shit, so to speak.
Yes, well, the indication, and we know this because we're writers, the indication of a writer is you want to focus more on the writing side of it, the more...
The dialogue, the character bits. And that's not an approach that I'm opposed to in a superhero movie, particularly one... That needs to be, I would argue, as psychologically driven as something like The Dark Phoenix needs to be. The problem is, I think what it all comes back to me, and I told you this in the theater as soon as we got out, the best way for me to describe this movie is presumptuous. It presumes that I care about these characters to a degree that I would argue the films that have preceded it have not earned in respect to these versions of the characters.
And the characters that it's focusing on.
Right.
If it was focused on Magneto and Xavier or whatever, like the rest of them have been, maybe, because we've grown accustomed to them. But this would be the equivalent of an Avengers movie coming out and asking us to buy Maria Hill as the main...
Right, as the main character. Yeah, and care about all the plight that she goes through in the course of the movie.
Exactly.
Kind of the presumptuous... Like I said, again, the presumptuousness of it, I don't really know another way to put it, I think is an issue. And just... Again, I'm all for psychologically driven, more slower-paced superhero movies. I mean, God, The Dark Knight, I would argue, is one of the more psychologically driven superhero movies, but it's interesting throughout. You don't feel that. And
The Dark Knight is a movie, when you watch for the first time, it's unpredictable.
Right.
There's nothing in Dark Phoenix that's unpredictable.
No, you know where everything is going pretty much the entire
time. And part of that is due to the marketing of the film.
Although there was one thing that I didn't see coming. And a mild spoiler here, they never name it in the movie. I had no clue the Genosha thing was coming.
Yeah, that was well done. So another issue that this movie has is I'm higher on Apocalypse than many. What I liked about Apocalypse, one of the things, is that even the bit players, the horsemen, the other acolytes of Apocalypse, they get names in the movie. So in this movie, Magneto has these prominent hench people that help him out. This guy with long dreadlocks.
Male Bianca Belair is what I call
him. Male Bianca Belair. And this chick that we learn can read minds or control minds and also has daggers for some reason. I don't know who they are, but they're in the movie. And at least as far as I remember, I could be totally off, but Nick was in the same boat as me, I think. I don't remember them ever getting named.
No, they weren't. Jessica Chastain's character is only named once.
Right.
So if you don't catch that name, Vuk.
And it's named in.
Luckily, it's in subtitles. That helped me lock it in. But my lord.
Yeah, so at no point does Magneto refer to any of them by name, which is a violation of the old Larry Hama rule from comics, where you always name the characters and for the first-time viewers. So that was a failure of the script, because these characters that, you know, have some pretty important scenes in the movie, because these are not just one and done. That hair guy is in one of the biggest action scenes in the film, fighting Storm. And I don't know their names. I don't know anything about them. I don't know their background. I don't know why they're blindly following Magneto. I don't know anything to do with them. So that's another failure of the film. Now, one of the areas where I think Nick and I disagree on the film, I was very high on the action scenes. I was impressed with, for a first-time director, that these action scenes are pretty spectacular to me.
Yes, the hangar for the jet has that, like, overly shiny, like, episode 3 level, like, sheen on all the green screen stuff when they're in the X-Hanger. But other than that...
And Charlie Sheen is superimposed on the side of it for some reason.
I think the Phoenix effects are mostly very well done. Honestly, the worst Phoenix effect is probably the one near the beginning, at the very beginning of the film, when they go to that Hollywood superhero trope of, if there's a great galactic force out there, we must portray it as a giant swirling doo-doo cloud.
Yes. Although this was a red doo-doo cloud. So
well, it had red and gray at the beginning. Where it was like, you know,
which is a dangerous combination.
My
digestive doctor has told me that.
But luckily, that they changed the color scheme of that throughout the movie, and I was worried that it was going to keep that same like red and like very dark hue. But they changed it to more of that like purples and yellows.
I was really, you know, I'm hard to impress with action scenes, but I thought the action scenes were really good in here, particularly the Genosha scene where the military comes and you get Magneto fighting against a turd to try to hold the plane together or the helicopter together and competing against Phoenix's powers. They both look like they're taking a dump, which is funny. But the any of the Magneto scenes are I'm such a mark for that effect they do where he just clenches his fist and squeezes all this metal onto somebody and crushes them with it. I thought Phoenix's effects looked good. The Nightcrawler effects are amazing. All of the teleportation stuff with Nightcrawler is spectacular. And he actually gets a few moments in this movie near the end to cut loose from an action standpoint. So that's one thing I will say. Everybody got something to do from an action standpoint in this movie. They all got a chance to use their abilities.
Okay, so not to interrupt, but the two characters we're talking about, the female with the blades is apparently Selene, created by Chris Claremont and Sal Buscema in New Mutants 9. The other one is a totally original character listed as Ariki.
Now, you've got one of the deepest... I'm getting halfway hot about this, Nick. You got one of the deepest franchises in terms of original characters in all of Marvel Comics. And you got to resort to creating original people to be mutants for you? Come on, now.
Apparently, according to this article from Den of Geek, they were going to have him as Red Lotus during the making of the movie, but then changed his name prior to release because he was never named in the movie because apparently he had no real similarities to the character of Red Lotus. So they just made him his own thing. And he has the lamest mutant power of all time, by the way. He just hits people with his hair.
Yes. Yes.
And not even like the hair can shoot out by itself. Right. He has to swing it with his hand.
Right. And he doesn't even do a 450 splash.
No, it's brutal.
No, it's not good.
He's the lame-est.
Yes. I see what you did there. So anyway, but the action scenes I think are really good. The best sequence to me is clearly the train fight at the end to me.
Disagree.
Really?
I think the opening sequence is sequences is the best. Yeah, because Quicksilver, first of all, which we didn't get, no other Quicksilver action sequences in the rest of the film, except for one brief moment when they have the showdown with Jean at her father's house.
Right.
Two, the best Nightcrawler stuff in the film. Coffee maker, don't worry about it. Right. The Nightcrawler sequence where he's jumping in and out of the ship, and then when he goes and gets Jean out of space, like, thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
The train sequence, I'm going to be honest, like, did nothing for me, really.
Really?
Outside of the cool moment near the end with Magneto having all the guns.
All the guns.
Yeah. That was cool. Other than that, it was just like these nameless, faceless...
Nightcrawler teleporting in with the blades and cutting everybody up with his tail and the blades.
Yeah, when he got pissed, that was cool too. But that was like a 15-second, like, it was over too quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was...
You get to see Storm with the lightning and, you know, I don't know. I think they did a good job in that scene of giving everybody a moment to shine, to show their powers and everything.
Right. I guess I was just... By that point in the film, I had felt it. Like, I was over it. Like, I was kind of...
I had to pee, really.
Yeah, bad. I was ready to be done. Like, I was like, I already know where this is going. She's going to take the power back from Vuk. She's probably going to disintegrate, and then...
She's going to share a knowing glance.
Share a knowing glance, and we're going to head off. Like, you know, what are
Rick,
we really doing?
Rick's going to nod.
Yep. So, yeah, I don't know. It just... I think I was just bored with it by that point. Bored, and not frustrated, really, but just... The movie really did bore me for long stretches, which is unfortunate, because even the X-Men movies that I haven't liked, I can't really say I was ever bored by Origins or bored by The Last Stand. And this one just... I think whoever was making the movie thought it was a lot more important than it actually was.
Yeah, yeah. And I can't say that I was really bored by it like Nick was. I was invested enough in the story to a degree and I liked, again, I love the action sequences. I thought they kind of salvaged it at the end. But even though I wasn't personally bored, I can acknowledge it was boring.
Yeah.
Because,
you know, it's crazy.
The stretches of...
We talk about it's really a Jean Grey movie, but think about, there are long stretches in this movie where she's not on screen.
Right.
And pretty much any time they did one of those,
unless Magneto was on. Because, like, Fassbender to me is so magnetic magnetic in these movies. that it works, but like, yeah, it was tough. There is another prominent death in the movie that, just in case you haven't had it spoiled by marketing, I don't want to spoil for you. There is another prominent death in the movie of one of the X-Men that they do a funeral sequence for, and the funeral sequence just fell so flat for me.
That's been spoiled in trailers.
I know, but some people might not have seen that particular trailer.
Okay, well, all I'll say about that is, I think that could have been the second best action sequence in the movie if I wasn't spending the entire thing going, well, I know exactly where this is going.
And see, I thought it was underwhelming from an action standpoint because they got overpowered so quickly.
The thing, though, is I felt the
emotional
weight of
yeah.
it in that one, whereas I didn't really feel it. By the time we got to the New York sequence and then later to the train sequence,
it didn't. Here's the thing to me. It didn't feel like any of the other X-Men took that X-Man's death that difficultly.
Other
than Beast.
Yeah.
Beast took it bad, and everybody else was just kind of like, oh, well, that person is gone. And
yeah, Scott goes, like, Scott starts justifying it
instantly.
Like, instantly. Which I would be able to buy to a degree if, again, we had seen him and Jean and, like, what...
Also, if this other character hadn't been raising them. From the time they were kids, basically,
yeah.
as part of this team.
Yeah.
Teaching them for years.
Years, 7 years.
Years to be members of the X-Men. There's some attachment there, some teacher-student attachment there that didn't come through in the film, in my opinion. So I think that was a waste of a death. And I'm not trying to compare... I'm not trying to compare it to Endgame, which is a top...
It's an unfair comparison.
But, like, the funeral scenes in that... Versus
God
the funeral scene
almighty.
Here, it's just not even... But any... I'm thinking about funeral scenes like Dark Knight Rises.
Right.
Logan. Whatever the scene, the movie may be, that has done this in a superhero standpoint.
By the way, isn't it odd that, like, of all the ways for that character to go out, they choose, like, wood through the chest? When we just did that in Logan?
Right.
Like, pick something... Pick literally anything else.
That imagery at this point is Logan's to own.
Yes.
So, it's... that was a weird... I didn't think about that. But yeah, I think that's part of the reason why that scene didn't do anything for me, because...
Well, the funeral scene was like 30 seconds. Charles Xavier reads some scripture, and then
right.
they're done. They're out of there.
And even the action scene preceding it, because of that fact, like, it was so unoriginal.
And during that action scene, we should mention, is where Quicksilver, in the second action sequence of the film, which is probably in the first half hour...
Sure, yeah.
...gets injured, quote, with air quotes, that you can't see because it's a podcast... And we're not told where he is. We're not told what's going on with him. He's just not in the movie again. And until
yeah.
the ending. Like, literally, they're right. just wrapping up and showing you whatever this, you know,
yes.
new status quo would have been had they continued.
And the audience is left with the knowledge, at least if they're hard-traveling fanboy-style audience, that they're never going to see this particular version of this character again.
Right.
Which sucks.
Yes.
He was very enjoyable. So, that's a bummer. But yeah, so I liked the action sequences. The acting was good. Pacing, not great. The
script is bad, I think.
The script
and the pacing are kind of tied together.
The
I don't think it's well edited either.
The predictability of the film is a big problem for me because, like, not a bit. I invested in the story enough. I did enjoy the movie enough, I guess. But, like, again, I knew every beat, pretty much every important beat in the movie. Mm-hmm. I knew where it was going. I was like, okay, I know exactly how this character is going to react. I know exactly how this character is going to react. I know exactly what this ending is going to be. And everybody's going to be, you know, I know what the status quo is going to be at the end for the most part.
The only thing that got me on with the ending was what they did with Xavier.
Yes, okay. I will say that as well. All of the negative things that I say about the movie from the writing standpoint, it does have a legitimately great ending to me. Because what it does with the Xavier and Magneto characters, to me, brings the whole film franchise full circle.
For not even the whole film franchise, but I would say more specifically the First Class series, like these four mm-hmm. films, for this close bond that we've gotten to see for these characters, I argued that you kind of needed to end here.
And a true evolution of Magneto, which is another thing that I think Last Stand screwed up on, is we never saw Magneto evolve. We never saw Magneto change.
But that's the same thing, you know, the same thing can be said, though, for that version of Charles Xavier. They mm-hmm. were, and it's not a bad, I'm not criticizing it, they were portraying in those films
the ideal and the opposite.
I would say the ideal comic book versions of both characters. Like, they were portraying the versions of those two characters that pop into your head instantly. They weren't really portraying characters that had to grow into those roles.
I think they were portraying the characters fully realized. I think they were portraying those characters as they were originally intended.
Right.
I don't think that version of Magneto is necessarily what I think of. Because when I think of Magneto, I do think of the complicated, not really a villain version of Magneto.
My point is, I get what you're saying. In terms of what the characters were supposed to be for that film franchise, they were fully realized in X-Men mm-hmm. from the first time they stepped on screen and never really changed the rest of the time.
They didn't have a journey. The journey was all the people that they were manipulating around.
Right, which, again, it's not a criticism. Those performances are great. I still think Ian McKellen's an outstanding Magneto. Same for Patrick Stewart as Xavier. These four films, however, have been preoccupied with developing these two characters. And I would argue, for the journey they've been on for four films now, I like ending it here with these two characters more than I would have.
Yeah.
And now they go off and create the X-Men and the Brotherhood and are at war for the rest of their lives.
Right, exactly. Totally agree. So, I don't know if there's anything else to say. The score was pretty good. I think it was Hans Zimmer score, I think?
Yeah, it was all right. I don't remember a single thing about it.
But other than that...
Oh, by the way, we should talk that train sequence real quick. I wanted to bring this up earlier and didn't. I do think it's funny that all our lead characters are being held prisoner by this evil military unit. That military unit, of course, the MCU, holding our beloved characters prisoner. You didn't notice that?
No, I didn't notice that.
They all had MCU patches, mutant control unit.
Okay, that's pretty funny. Yeah, that feels like a Deadpool gag.
I laughed pretty hard at that.
That's pretty good. So credit there to this one. But other than that, you know, a largely unremarkable movie that told a story that didn't need to be told, really.
I wouldn't say that it didn't. It wasn't time to tell.
At this time, it didn't need to be told. Here's the thing. Everybody's obsessed with the Dark Phoenix saga. And I get it. It's probably the most famous. That and Days of Future Past are the two most famous X-Men stories. But X-Men have a buttload of great stories. Okay? Like, the X-Men franchise has so many amazing stories from its history that are not rooted in the Dark Phoenix saga. So, my point is, if you want to tell the Dark Phoenix story, great. But you don't have to tell it right when you've introduced the new team of mutants. You can do a Mojo story. You can do a Mr. Sinister story.
Which they've been teasing for years.
You can do any number of amazing stories over the years. Joss Whedon's Astonishing X-Men could be probably converted over. Nimrod, you know, all these weird, bizarre characters from over the years that you could utilize in your stories. I mean, hell, just go and listen to an episode of Conversation Comics.
Right.
And you can find great X-Men stories to mine that aren't the Phoenix Saga or the Dark Phoenix Saga. Or hell, here's a story. Tell the Phoenix Saga.
Yeah, I was about to say, why not take another X-Men villain or another X-Men story and just, like, work in Jean Grey being, the heroic version of the Phoenix into that? Yeah. And then that gets you, like, thing is, I don't have a problem with them wanting to do Dark. It's the same thing I always say, like, when I know you and I have butted heads about this before. What's the dude's name that's doing the Batman?
Matt Reeves.
If he wants to do the Joker at some point, I have no issue with him doing a Joker movie. None. Because when they give you the keys to the kingdom, you want to play with the biggest, shiniest toy in the toy box. And for Batman fans, it's the Joker. And for many X-Men fans, they think of the Dark Phoenix saga as this thing that they want to see, they want to put their own spin on. But my thing is, if you're going to do that, you can't just do it right away. You have to take the necessary steps, build it up, and get there in an organic fashion to make us care. And that is the problem here. And, you know, because, and we'll talk about this next week, and I need to rewatch the movie to really remember, you know, to jog my memory on how all this happened. But when the first time around, when Last Stand was getting ready to come out, I think we were invested. They had done their legwork. And I know I'm criticizing this one for not having a heroic Phoenix part of it, and no, the Bryan Singer original trilogy didn't either. I understand that. But we had spent so much time with the characters that I was willing to accept going to Dark Phoenix. We had that existing.
That's what we wanted. Yeah. We just didn't want the stuff with the Cure and all that other
crap. Right. This one, however, is just like, it's more focused on the Dark Phoenix stuff. But we don't care about the characters. And you got to have both. You got to have that focus and the emotion and the buy-in from the audience.
Right. And I think my argument is that, like, when you're dealing with a franchise character that has that much depth, whether it's Batman or the X-Men, put on your big boy pants and eat the fact that you can't do the Joker for a while and do a story about the Riddler or a character that people haven't seen before. Do something that's going to surprise and shock the audience that might give the audience an idea that this is not a one character, one villain character. And the X-Men are not that. The X-Men are loaded with characters. And so my point is, like, there were so many different directions you could go to get to Dark Phoenix. Mm-hmm. Well, you didn't need to get to it two movies in.
I think we're agreeing on that standpoint.
Yeah.
I think you sound less enthusiastic in general about even getting to Dark Phoenix.
No. I think it's a story you can tell over time because it was butchered so badly last time.
I think we would agree. The degree of the misfire will settle next week. But I think we both agree they've screwed it up twice.
Yes.
Do you have any interest in seeing the MCU tackle the material at this point?
No.
None.
No. I'm saying that definitively in a non-definitive manner because I don't want them to come out of the gates.
I didn't say out of the gates. I said, do you have
what? It depends because what Marvel franchise, the farthest we've gotten in any Marvel franchise is 3 movies, right? Avengers with 4.
Yeah.
Avengers with 4. Do I want to see the Dark Phoenix as one of the first 4 X-Men movies? No, absolutely not. I'm not interested in it anymore.
Even if it was like the 4th X-Men movie?
No. Nope.
And see, I differ on that. I
can name you right now X-Men stories I'd rather see than the Phoenix Saga.
Even if it was done well. Because, it almost assuredly would be.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's old hat. It's predictable. It's predictable at this point. I know how, everybody and their mother knows how it ends now. So, I'm not interested in it. There's nothing you can do to it to really, the only thing you can do to mix it up is, ooh, maybe you have, instead of Cyclops seeing her die, maybe it's Wolverine, or maybe it's Beast, or maybe it's somebody else. It's just, there's nothing about that story that can surprise me. They've beaten it to death in the comics.
Yeah.
They've done the Phoenix Saga over and over again. 400 times now.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm done with it. I don't need it anymore.
Because you kind of look at the Spider-Man franchise saying, well, you don't want Osborn.
I don't want Osborn. But what I do want is, if they were going to redo a character in the MCU, I'd rather them redo Apocalypse, do an Age of Apocalypse movie.
I would agree with that.
So, you know, there's so many directions to go.
So you
want to limit yourself to one story.
because we all know MCU X-Men is coming.
Yes.
What form that takes and what the approach is, but mm-hmm. you want them to basically take the Spider-Man route where, since Spider-Man is coming to the MCU, two movies now, zero villains that were adapted previously.
Yes. Preferably. Unless they redo Apocalypse. I'd be fine with that. But, like, I don't want Magneto. I know two things. I don't want the Dark Phoenix, and I don't want Magneto as the villain. Because we got that with
the... As the main villain.
Yeah, the Singer verse.
He can be in the movie, but...
He can be in the movie, but honestly, I don't need to see him as that villain that controls things from the background or any of that crap. He was the main villain of three X-Men movies in a row. Wait, four X-Men movies in a row. For no reason. Wait. Last Stand. What was the next one after that? First Class? He was in that. He wasn't the villain, but he was a villain in that movie. So
was he a villain in First Class, though? I would...
By the end of it, he cripples Charles Xavier and goes off on his own.
That was an accident, though. It was a special effect for
the movie. And then he's the bad guy in Days of Future Past.
Yeah, you're right, because he inadvertently...
So it's like, I don't need to see that. There's more than just Magneto out there. And you know, there are one-off characters like Juggernaut or Apocalypse that they could redo, and I'd be fine with. But Sabretooth, we haven't gotten we got a good performance, but we haven't gotten a satisfactory Sabretooth on the big screen. So there's plenty of great characters that they can delve into. But yeah, I'm like that with the Osborns or Joker or whatever. Not to say that one day you can't have Osborns or you can't have the Joker or you can't have Lex Luthor or whatever. But by God, man, when are we going to get a Brainiac movie versus Superman? When are we going to get, you know, somebody that isn't a real estate tycoon or whatever the hell?
No, we're going to get Zod again at some point.
Oh, God, get over it. There's more than just two villains. So anyway, with all that being said, I think both of us have been clear that this movie is disappointing. Not just my expectations were so low. I can't say it's disappointing.
Yeah, I was about to say the same thing.
But it's just what's the phrase from Young Justice? Whelming.
Whelming. Yeah. In terms of my expectations, which were super low, I would say my expectations were met.
Yeah.
And normally is a good thing. In this case, it's a bad thing because like I had the lowest of bars for this to clear to be a pleasant surprise. Yeah. And the fact that it couldn't even clear that low bar, I think, is a pretty good indication.
Yeah, I liked it more than Nick did, but not enough to recommend it to anybody. So, you know, I mean, I think some people will take more enjoyment out of it than others. There were parts of it that I really, really liked. But ultimately, it's going to settle in near the bottom of my X-Men movie list.
I think tentatively right now, I'm going to put it at number 10.
Same for me. We'll have a chance to revisit that next week.
First Class.
Right now, I've got it clearly ahead of X-Men Origins and ahead of The Last Stand.
Right, me as well. There's no way I'm going to drop it below Origins.
I don't imagine I will elevate it above First Class. I think I like First Class more than this one.
Oh, I didn't even know. First Class off the table as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
We were talking about tiers last week?
Yeah.
There is a gap between this and First Class.
Yeah, so we'll see. To me, the argument is Last Stand versus this,
yes.
And we'll settle that next week.
And I think what's going to be interesting with Last Stand is, I think there's a strong argument to be made that like the plot of Last Stand is worse, and some of the scripting may be worse. But I think the emotional investment in those versions of the characters
is stronger. And I think you could argue that the performances are better in this one. However, with a couple of exceptions, and there may be the most important exception, which is
Hugh Jackman,
which is the sacrifice scene, which, if you know the Phoenix saga, there's a sacrifice scene at the end, of course, of any of these Phoenix adaptations. The Jean Grey sacrifice in this movie doesn't hold a candle to the sacrifice in Last Stand.
So you kept calling it a sacrifice scene earlier, and like, having never read the Dark Phoenix saga, a guilty admission of mine, I didn't even read what she did at the end of the sacrifice.
Well, she makes it clear that like if she tries to kill this creature, it's going to kill all the rest of the X-Men, all the people that she loves.
Mm-hmm.
So she makes the decision to take it up into the atmosphere and to burn them both out, basically.
But then we know that she isn't burned out by the end of the movie,
right? Well, that's kind of the idea, is that they give you the hope that the Phoenix will rise again, because mm-hmm. it's not Stefano D'Amira, Days of Our Lives fans, but. But the sacrifice in Last Stand, that scene, that gutting scene where Wolverine has to gut Jean Grey,
mm-hmm.
is powerful. And even in the midst of a bad movie, it's powerful. And it's one that that
and maybe
works
I'm,
because of the performances. This scene, I felt nothing right. when she died at the end, which is bad because she did a good job.
And also for Last Stand, maybe I'm misremembering, but like we can debate whether or not the subplot should have been in the movie, but I remember really feeling for Rogue in like the Cure subplot of like, here's this character who all she wants is like a genuine human connection mm-hmm. with somebody, and she can't have it because of her powers.
Right.
And so like, you know, I feel like there are going to be more characters in Last Stand that I wind up caring
time,
about.
Yeah, they had time to build up one story arc, not three different timelines or something like that. And so, you know, there was just more to it and in that regard. So that's one thing that I think this movie also, while I overall enjoyed this Jean Grey, I think more than I enjoyed Jean in that movie.
Mm-hmm. I bet you did. She's playing 12 going on 13 in the first season of Game of Thrones, for the record, Greg.
I don't need to watch first. I can watch the last season of Game of Thrones.
You should watch all seasons of Game of Thrones.
The culmination of this movie was certainly leaves something to be desired. And also, kind of made me, I don't know if you felt this way, you probably didn't, but I kind of felt this in Apocalypse as well. I really did miss Hugh Jackman's presence in both of these last two
movies. He was in Apocalypse,
movies.
Though.
Only briefly.
True.
He shows up as a Weapon X scene. But I missed his presence in these movies. He adds a lot.
He does, but I think the character of Wolverine in general does. And it's going to be tricky going forward because does the MCU try to introduce the X-Men without Wolverine?
Out of the gates or at all?
Out of the gates, at least.
Yeah, I don't know out of the gates. It's tough to say. Did they go with the original class of X-Men, Angel and Beast and the rest of them?
Please no. I tell you what,
I got an idea.
For me personally, as something of a novice fan, just give me the animated series lineup. Like, exactly the animated series lineup.
I got an idea. Introduce Wolverine the way he was in the comics as a foil for the Hulk.
That would be interesting.
Of course, it's kind of hard to do that now with the status of the Hulk in the MCU that he is now.
Right.
Maybe they can undo that at some point. But anyway, with all that being said, let's wrap this first half up. If you guys have seen the movie and you have any thoughts on it, please shoot us an email. Greg P.
If you just read the spoilers for it and want to share thoughts, I mean, that's going around right now, so do that.
Greg P. at PlaceToBeNation.com, Nick D. at PlaceToBeNation.com, Twitter, whatever, at GPhillips8652.
At NickDuke87.
Yep.
Probably going to change my my Twitter handle to at whooping Greg's ass in GM mode here pretty soon.
Who's on top right now is you. But who's about to be on top is me. Yeah. I just made up a huge difference on our shows.
Yeah.
Folks, we're not live streaming our battle right now.
We should be.
But it's, you know, I'm confident that's going
to turn out. It's ebbs and flows.
Yeah. There are certainly names involved, like the Boogeyman, that you would not expect to be involved mm-hmm. in a 2019 wrestling promotion. But
Greg stabbing his childhood hero in the back and trading him to another brand.
He lost the Loser Leaves Town match. I had no choice. I had to honor the stipulations of my show. Mm-hmm. I traded him for the American Dream Dusty Rhodes. So.
No one cares about this.
Well, I don't. I mean, did anyone care about the rest of it?
No.
Fair enough. So we're going to take a break now. When we come back, we've got reading, watching, the rundown, the live read, JR's barbecue singing festival, and the Wrestling Minute.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceofNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceofNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceofNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. The hard-traveling fanboys. Back in our usual arrangement, back in the L-shaped studio here in the building, in the Ho-Ho Loon Plaza. And I've got a couple of news items to talk about in a few minutes, but first, we want to tell you all about the busy week we've had right here at Place to Be Nation, Place to Be Nation Pop, and Place to Be Nation Wrestling. For starters, in the series finale of DC Post-Crisis Management, Russell Sellers and guest Todd Weber take a look at Heroes in Crisis and complete Russell's twisting and turning journey through the DC Universe crisis-level events. Then after that, Russell and Todd announce the debut of their brand new podcast, DC For You. In the first episode of this weekly show, the guys kick off celebrating the anniversaries of Batman and Batman 89 with none other than Walter Don Nicholas Brandenburg Duke.
Nah.
There he is. You can also catch our shows in the archives here as we recently kicked off X-Men Month with a ranking.
I like X-Month myself.
That works too, X-Month. What about Month, man, that doesn't work as well.
No.
Anyway, we kick things off with a countdown of our entire X-Men movie rankings. Starting from 11 to 1, we rank all the X-Men movies before Dark Phoenix came out. So be sure to check that out. And of course, last month was Avengers Month. Lots of great material there. In the 28th episode of Songs with Friends, Steve and Kelly feature Bob Seger's Night Moves, a song that I know Nick is quite fond of, and one of my middle and high school anthems, Third Eye Blind's Ode to Meth, Semi-Charmed Life. The NBA team is back with Gone Fishing Part 2 as Andrew and Adam go west, presumably to talk about my Utah Jazz, the only team that matters in the West. The second episode of PTBN E-Ticket Attraction finds host Jason Sherman and guests Andy Atherton, Neil Trauma, and Chad Campbell talking everything Epcot. Be sure to keep an eye on our social media feeds as the reboot of the Greatest Songs of the 80s tournament is starting soon. Sorry for that delay. And meanwhile, Nick, what do we have going on over at the PTBN Wrestling Feed?
Absolutely. On the Place to Be podcast, Justin Scott and guest John D'Amato wrap up the summer with a hot review of SummerSlam 1989.
That's hot.
On a new Talkin' WCW, Jenny, Tim, and some piece of trash named Greg Phillips discuss a trio of matches.
Ain't never tagged with nobody.
Featuring the natural Dustin Rhodes.
That's right.
On the seventh episode of Row One, Seat One, Ben Zani welcomes Southern Underground Pro promoter Kevin Q and gets a behind-the-scenes look at their latest event. And then finally, Scott Crisolo, Nate Milton, and Steve Willey recap Double or Nothing and some classic TNA, an oxymoron if there ever was one, on the newest edition of Main Event. Meanwhile, on PlaceToBeNation.com, check out the newest Draft Wars, in which PTBN staff members drafted takeover matches. Pick the best roster and vote for your favorite. Also available on the site is the latest installment of PTBN's excellent WWE Network adventure, with an in-depth look at Mid-South Wrestling from 5/26/84. Check out our social media pages and message board at bigelow34.proboards.com.net/gov. For information on joining our GWWE PPV and TV Match Ever project, get in on the conversation today and start researching your list.
That was masterfully done. I mean, just a walk through podcasting professionalism, if I ever heard it.
Oh, we are nothing here at Place to Be Nation, if not a serious professional endeavor.
That's right. Well, speaking of serious professional endeavors, Nick, I think it's time that we move on right past reading and watching, because we haven't read or watched a darn thing, have we?
No, I don't believe we have, other than the aforementioned Dark Phoenix, which we talked about in the first half of the show. So, reading and watching this week. And we're moving right on to the rundown.
Our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics, the rundown.
Oh, Charles, welcome to the rundown.
And I wanted to start things off, Nick. I want to go off script a little bit here. This is not in the format, folks.
Come to think of it, we didn't actually build a format for the rundown, so this ought to be interesting.
Well, what I want to start off with, Nick, is some news that our good friend Russell Sellers just alerted me to
a group chat. Here we go.
And that is there is a
this is a photo, Greg. This is an audio show.
No. This is news. This was retweeted by none other than our beloved Kurt Busiek, one of our favorites here at Place to Be Nation Pop. This gentleman is a politician, John Oxendine, who ran for governor of Georgia in 2010. And he is most notable, not for being a politician, but for having basketball hair. What do I mean by basketball hair? If you've ever seen a drawing of Norman and Harry Osborn or the Sandman in Spider-Man comics, this is a human being who has the exact perfect hair for Norman Osborn, which certain people on this podcast have informed me did not exist. So I tell you, Hollywood, I challenge you, Marvel Studios, to find an actor that can portray Norman Osborn and to craft his hair to look like a basketball. Simple.
Are you done?
Maybe. Maybe I am. Maybe I'm not. What business is it of yours?
Can we move on?
Well, I suppose if you really want to move on, I'd be fine talking about this for another 2 hours.
What more is there to discuss?
Well, I mean, the intricacies of the hair care products you'd have to put into it to work. What percentage of the budget of the third Spider-Man movie should be spent on Osborn's hair? I mean, there's a lot of nuances here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go with a street level Spider-Man villain to reduce the need for special effects so that you can make the hair right? I'd argue yes. Eloquently stated. Well, we're just going to go in the order that we have these listed in our chat for these other items.
We might we might not. I might call some audibles throughout, but we'll start there. Yeah, go ahead.
You don't have the power to do that.
I do have the power to do that.
I can, and I have the power to ignore your audibles.
We'll just start talking about two different things.
I call my own plays.
Go ahead.
Nick. DC Universe's Swamp Thing has been canceled.
Mm-hmm.
And this came out, of course, last week, Nick. We're a little bit behind the eight ball on it, but them's the breaks. Just 6 days after it premiered on the streaming service DC Universe, Swamp Thing was canceled. A lot of rumors and innuendo out there on the internet about the reasons for the cancellation. Don't know what's true. Don't know what's false. One thing that is clear is that the executives were not high on the show from the get-go. Also, there were some funding issues. It has a very large budget for a TV show, for a streaming service that isn't Netflix. So it had some uphill battles to fight. But nonetheless, this has really upset a lot of people, including the director, James Wan, who, according to his Twitter account or Instagram,
direct or produce?
He produced it.
Yeah,
he is a director.
Yes,
who produced Swamp Thing? He executive produced it, I should say. He said on Instagram, "quote Don't really know or understand why Swamp Thing was canceled." He said he was really proud of the cast and crew's work on the show. This has upset a lot of people that enjoyed the pilot episode. It was getting mostly good reviews. and people were excited for it going forward and for it being more of a close adaptation of Alan Moore's legendary Swamp Thing run. But reports surfaced that higher ups at Warner Media were not high on the show from the get-go, didn't get the concept.
There were early reports that indicated there was some sort of tax rebate issue in North Carolina, that those reports seem to have been debunked by a variety of sources at this point. From what we can gather, and you know, information is kind of slowly revealing itself on this matter, but right now it just looks like, for whatever reason, high ups at Warner or DC or AT&T or whoever just flat out didn't like the show for whatever reason.
Right, and they were hoping to get it picked up by either HBO or the CW, both of which ended up passing on the show. So it's kind of dead. Plus, if the reported budget is true of $80 million, that's a lot of money to sink into a project that they don't have faith in for whatever reason. They didn't have faith in it. To me, it makes me wonder at this point if the executives that are running DC Comics – not DC Comics. The executives that are running Warner's DC wing are actually even aware of or fans of the products that they own. do you honestly think that whoever these Warner Brothers executives are have ever actually read Alan Moore's – I haven't read Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, but I've read a lot of Swamp Thing appearances. I've read a lot of Alan Moore comics. I get the feeling that these guys probably haven't. So
I would agree with that. That's definitely the feeling you get. But this is just another – the latest thing in DC over at DC that kind of has us concerned with the entire, I guess, corporate landscape over there. And I think our next item kind of ties right into that.
Yeah, this one less so though, because I think this is one of those stories where if you read the original story that it's based on, it isn't nearly as haunting as it's made to seem in this news.
Yes, however, the one that we're using for the purpose of this story or this podcast, there have been others as well, including a more in-depth Hollywood Reporter one that did say that there are legitimate reconsiderations being made here.
Well, the article that I'm reading from Deadline is that after the cancellation of Swamp Thing, it says, like every other initiative, DC Universe is being reevaluated following the completion of AT&T acquisition of Time Warner, as Warner Media has put an emphasis on the launch of its new streaming platform. There have been questions of how DC Universe fits into those plans. That doesn't necessarily mean that these questions – it doesn't say who's asking these questions. It doesn't mean if there are questions about its existence or just what role it will take on.
Right.
So it's really kind of a vaguely worded report, honestly, at this point. We just don't know a lot about this situation right now vis-a-vis and I'm clicking on this Hollywood Reporter story right now, Nick, to get some background on it. Yes, executives have yet to unveil how the DC Universe streaming platform will work with the planned AT&T WB streaming app. Let's see here. Despite promising reviews, insiders believe that they have a dud on their hands, and rather than pull the plug on the show and lose millions already invested with nothing to show for it, opted instead to complete work on the series and use it to bolster the library content on the DC Universe platform. So that's interesting. So they didn't even wait for outside reviews. The insiders in the studio, as the show was being developed, thought it was going to be a bust.
Right.
Is there a company that has less faith in its intellectual properties than Warner Brothers?
Not many.
Goodness gracious.
Not many that I can think of, for sure. It's frustrating.
It's not like DC Comics has been around since basically the 1930s, right?
No, not at all. Not the way they treat it and micromanage it right now, no. But, you know, on the DC Universe app itself, on that front, you don't want to get too alarmed. But honestly, if I'm looking at it from as AT&T from a larger perspective, I would probably be leaning towards incorporating the DC Universe video content into whatever this larger streaming service is, because you're going to have to compete with the library that Netflix has. You're going to have to compete with the library that that Disney is going to have. You want all your big guns there on this Warner streaming service. And I've said before, I would be perfectly fine if DC Universe became a comics-only platform. So long as our original content that we do want, such as Titans and Young Justice, still had a home over on the Warner service.
Right. And as long as that comic book content is updated and maintained, which it is right now, then to me, it's still worth the value of what I'm paying for it. So the Warner Media app then would have to be priced competitively, obviously, which I don't know if you read the rumored price point they were looking at, but not too crazy about that. But I guess if it has all of the
– I was about to say that's including HBO and Cinemax content.
Oh, though, yeah.
Which is true. Like – which is – I think HBO Now right now, or HBO Go or whichever one it is, standalone is like $14 a month.
Right.
So
you add – it's like $2 more to get
– Cinemax and all that, and you know, let's not forget certain advantages that come with having Cinemax content bundled in.
Yes, like the ability to watch the new Bruce Lee-inspired show Warrior.
That's exactly what I was referring to.
Absolutely. So sources say DCU's original scripted content could be folded into the Warner Media service, could remain exclusive to its own platform, or employ a windowing strategy between the two brands. Mm. I don't know what that means, Nick.
It means that each one would get the rights to it for a window of time, and it would likely perhaps alternate, or you would have it on DCU for 3 months before it went to Warner Media full-time, or vice versa, depending.
I think that's stupid.
No. I do, too. If you're going to have mobile streaming services, like, you know, it's tough to say because Disney right now is doing a similar thing now that they have full control of Hulu. But there's a legitimate reason for that in that one is going to host family-friendly content and one isn't, you know. One's going to host a lot of things that have, you know, are being licensed from outside providers and that are a little bit more on the adult theme side. So if I'm
– adult themed, you say?
Yes. If I'm AT&T, why are you going to maintain – multiple different video services? I say give everybody the most bang for their buck. You know, go out there and try to build the biggest one-stop shop to compete with the Disney and Netflix apps.
You might even create the biggest icon in wrestling.
Mm. No, that will never happen again. There's only one of those.
Well, that notwithstanding, quite frankly, it's not all cancellation news or migration news for DC, because on the film front, there's actually a little bit of movement on a long gestating project.
Mm.
This project is the planned big screen adaptation of Black Adam, starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson. This has been talked about for, gosh, what, 3-4 years at least, Nick. And Rock has actually been trying to make a Black Adam movie even going further back than that, so before the even existence of the supposed DCEU. So apparently Jaume Collet-Serra, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that name, who has just finished directing The Rock on Jungle Cruise for Disney, has been mentioned as the frontrunner to direct New Line Cinema's Black Adam movie. Now, this has been, reported as such. It's not official yet that he's been hired on to do it, but it certainly looks like it's trending in that direction. He has a working relationship with The Rock and Seven Bucks Production. So it looks like this may be a thing that happens, Nick. So maybe this Black Adam movie that has been sort of sitting in the ether for what feels like half a decade at this point is finally going to get moving maybe in this next year or so.
Yeah, certainly seems that way. So let's hope that winds up being the case.
Indeed so. I still maintain that I would like to see him show up in a Shazam sequel if that happens.
I do too. Although, you know, Shazam seems to be inconsistent on what the actual reaction to the box office take will. Some people think it's an resounding success. Some people think it's a bit of a disappointment. So it's, you know, I guess it all depends on what Warner Brothers thinks, because I've heard no movement yet on a Shazam sequel.
Well,
typically, when these things do well, they're in such a rush to get word out there that the sequel's coming.
That's for sure about Warner Brothers is that whatever decision they make, they will either greenlight 17 sequels or they will cancel the project and never do a Shazam movie again.
Yes.
All right. Now, speaking of deceased movie properties, let's move over to the Fox film universe, superhero film universe. A report came
out. Oh, hey, real quick before we move on from DC, a little bit of breaking news late.
Quite frankly.
Sorry, didn't mean to to jump in on the comic side, Batman writer Tom King has tweeted out an image today, a teaser for his upcoming Batman Catwoman miniseries that reveals he will be introducing the character of the Phantasm to the DC Comics printed universe.
There you have it. What was her name? Andrea Beaumont, I believe.
Andrea Beaumont from the original. Now, will it be Andrea Beaumont beneath the mask? No one knows, but
could be Holly Robinson.
Could be Holly Robinson. I would argue that probably makes a lot of sense. But anyway, you've got the Phantasm coming, which is cool.
It is. And a movie that we should probably do for Off the Page at some point in the future.
God, yeah.
Anyway.
Those make for the worst Off the Pages, though, because that's going to be a movie that we would just sit there and be like, isn't this great? Look how great this is.
Isn't it good?
And then we just sit there for long stretches watching the movie.
Yes. Yes. Sort of like what happened with me on well, it hasn't come out yet, but there's an episode of Laugh in Theater that I've been on that I felt like I didn't deliver as a guest because it was Austin Powers, and I just found myself watching the movie
right
for large portions of it, and I can't help it. It's such a great movie. Anyway, so anyway, a report came out, one of those report colons, that at one time earlier in this decade, 20th Century Fox was planning a major crossover between its Marvel Comics film properties. This would have been an X-Men and Fantastic Four crossover that would have been essentially the Fox version of Civil War. X-Men first-class screenwriters Edward Miller and Zack Stentz were hired in 2010 to write the crossover, which would have kicked off with a massive explosion caused by Johnny Storm, the Human Torch. And per the trade Hollywood Reporter's secret source, the X-Men would have responded to the incident, leading the teams to take sides and fight. Naturally, the X-Men would be falling on the side, Nick, of the pro-registration.
Yes, absolutely. If there's anything I think of when I think of the X-Men, it's let's all get together and get behind back the government, because they've never done anything bad to us before.
The big battle would have reportedly culminated – this is absolutely ridiculous, by the way – would have reportedly culminated in Mr. Fantastic turning his arms into super-thin, razor-sharp scissors and cutting off Wolverine's arm. After that, the team would have settled their differences after Wolverine's arm grows back, I guess. In preparation for a team-up movie where they fight off a Skrull invasion. Oh, good Lord. Apparently Daredevil was also going to be involved in it.
Yes. And all the properties that Fox had the rights to.
Paul Greengrass was named as a possible director.
Good Lord.
Presumably he looked at the script and said, absolutely not.
Seinfeld gif.
Oh, God. This sounds awful.
It almost sounds too awful to be true, but oftentimes those things that sound too awful to be true wind up being true, so who knows what to make of it. Let's just all be glad that our new mouse-eared overlords have control of the X-Men, and things are where they should be.
I don't know about all that, but the one thing that I can say is I am certainly glad that we did not get Hula Hoop Havoc versus Sue Richards in a fight or anything. That would have been too much for me.
Or Mr. Fantastic versus Wolverine in a climactic action sequence.
Or Mr. Fantastic versus Darwin.
Oh, God.
I
don't know. That X-Men First Class is very important, Greg, which makes it good, apparently.
Wait just a moment here. How important was Blade, do you think?
It was pretty damn important. Yeah.
Yep.
Suicide Squad made a bunch of money, so doesn't that make it important and thus good?
Isn't it good, Beavis? where are we at now? Oh, yes. Yes, this is one I wanted to talk about. Speaking of the X-Men, speaking of your beloved Disney overlords, The X-Men animated cast and writers are pushing Disney. Disney.
Triple H is reading this rundown story, apparently.
To bring back X-Men the animated series in some form. They are hoping – the creators of the series are hoping to meet with Disney executives about the potential for reviving the show.
Oh, my God.
The cast recently got back together for the first time in ages. Why not do this if you're Disney? I mean, this could take many forms, Nick. This could be an animated movie, a series of animated movies. This could be a TV series on the streaming service. It would not require a huge budget because let's face it, the animation style is what it is. Wouldn't take a gigantic budget. Wouldn't take that much time and effort, I don't think. Why not? Why not try this? Why not give it a shot? I think that there's a market for this particular take on the X-Men, which was the most popular and most widely experienced take on the characters.
And
so
it would undoubtedly raise the profile of the back catalog of the original episodes on your new streaming service that you're trying to drive people to. So on multiple fronts, it's going to raise the profile of something in your library that you could. That's another way for you to monetize this. And it's a relatively, as you said, a relatively cheap form of original content for this new streaming service, and you're going to be in the content game, competing with other platforms and providers to provide the largest library for your viewers to choose from. So,
assuming that the old X-Men show is going to be available on there,
Yeah, I mean they have the rights to it at this point, so you know I would assume it is. But even if it's not, throw it up on there. I mean, why not?
Right, and the other aspect of this is if you're worried about branding concerns, if you're worried about, well, we don't want kids to get confused and think this is our, you know, they get their X-Men team confused, just brand it as X-Men 92 like they did in the comics.
And just only have it on the streaming service. Don't have it anywhere else. Don't have it on Disney XD or anything like that. Keep it exclusive to the streaming service. Make it so that anyone who wants to watch this is going to have to go out and see and search it out, which is pretty common in today's landscape. I mean, I don't really see any drawbacks to doing this other than the only way I could see it is like, maybe hand-drawn animation, because it's so rare these days, is, you know, a little bit more expensive than it used to be. But like the animation for that show wasn't exactly overly detailed. So just do it. Do it, damn it.
Do it because we want it.
That's right.
And with that being said, there's one more item we have to get to here. And this is the release and unveiling at E3, the Gaming Expo, which took place this past weekend. The unveiling of the first official Marvel Avengers game since Ultimate Alliance 2, I believe.
Well, Ultimate Alliance 3 will be out next month. So,
but certainly there's been a huge gap in Avengers games in the last 10 years. And really Marvel games, just Spider-Man was the first major Marvel game in what felt like forever, outside of some dabbles here and there that didn't really work out. Spider-Man got a huge reception, and this is the Marvel's Avengers game from Square Enix, which will be available first as a beta on the PS4. This will drop in May 15th, 2020. They released the first trailer, and I know some that are excited about it, but it has not gotten great reviews online. It's very divisive. I think that's fair to say. Nick, I'll let you lead us off.
Considering they didn't really show much gameplay, it's not really fair to comment on that, at least as far as the trailer is concerned. From the cinematic stuff, I thought it looked good. I'm not
interesting.
I'm not really a graphics whore anymore. The graphics are fine to me. I'm not looking for, you know, photorealism. And the story looks right up my alley. The Avengers, basically, it seems like, fuck up and have to suffer for 5 years before getting back together. What about this am I not supposed to love, Greg?
Well, my boss described it as looking like 2003's best Avengers game. Others online have described it as laughable graphics given the current generation capabilities.
I don't agree with that. It's not it's just because it's not, you know, I'm trying to think of what the comparison is. What was that? Detroit, Beyond Human or
Beyond Human or whatever. Or Red Dead or, you know, your Metal Gear Solids or whatever. I mean, there's no getting around it. I got to be honest with you. I know I'm going to get shit for this, but I don't care. I think the character models are terrible. Like, I don't think Black Widow looks anything like any version of Black Widow I've ever seen. She doesn't even have Russian features. Captain America looks like a douche with a stupid costume that looks like it came off the set of a CW show. Thor looks like a hobo.
Thor does not look like a hobo. He looks like Thor.
He looks like a – they tried way too hard with this suit, opinion. Hulk looks good. Banner looks good. The voices – maybe the voices will grow on me in the game. Banner sounded good. I thought all the other voices sounded bad in the trailer. What we see of the gameplay glimpses don't thrill me. Hulk was probably my favorite part, seeing him throw people. Maybe that'll be an aspect of the game that'll be fun. I'm hoping that the game is good and fun, and I'm going to wait to judge the game until then. I'm just going off the trailer, the same way you can judge the Dark Phoenix trailer or whatever. That's kind of my reaction to this. I'm just like, we can judge the CGI in a movie. I can judge the graphics in a game in 2019, and I was not impressed. But that's just me. Maybe I'll change my mind once I see it, once it comes time for the game to come out. And I'm also concerned about the description of the game as being compared to stuff like Destiny and things like that. Not that I'm knocking those games. They're probably great games. But for what I want out of an Avengers game, I really don't want that sort of massive shared universe thing with other people. In other words, I don't want a bunch of Captain Americas and a bunch of Thors running around interacting with each other. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's described as a service type game, and I've never played Destiny. So, Nick, I don't think you have either, but I am somewhat concerned about that aspect of the game. And I got to be honest, my expectations for this game are sky high, and the trailer just kind of left me like underwhelmed, I guess. I don't know what I was expecting.
Yeah, like I said, just the trailer, but you know, the gameplay stuff wasn't really even in there. All I'm looking at is the story. Looks like a story that's up my alley, so I'm excited for it.
Yes.
What is that noise?
That was me typing. And yeah, we'll see. I don't want to come off too harsh towards it, just because it really underwhelmed me. And I remember last night, I think I sent you a message saying, boy, that trailer left me cold. And it seems to be a divisive and even divide among people that are really excited about it and people that are kind of like, you know, that kind of looks kind of like trash a little bit. So it's kind of like, I'm sure it'll when it comes time for the game, they have a lot. This is almost not quite a year to develop this and get it ready for release. So they'll
and
figure it
games,
out.
Games, even more so than movies or comics, are prone to undergo release date delays. So, like, you know, just because it's announced a year out doesn't mean it actually hits that date. So, I'm sure they'll take their time on it. Like you said, my issues will probably likely wind up being more conceptual. Like, do I really want to play an Anthem or Destiny style game? Not so much. And I don't think that is going to change.
Right. I can't even judge that because I've never played those games. I don't know how the
multiplayer works. I don't want to play with other people. I want to play by myself and be a loner, damn it. And I'm tired of you constantly dragging me in, you know, game companies trying to drag me into the cesspool that is online multiplayer.
Yes, I agree with that. But what about like something like Ultimate Alliance?
Yeah, that's fun when we're together in a room. Like, we don't need to play that. We never played that online.
No, we would if somebody had bought it when it was on sale. but that's neither here nor there, quite frankly. Well, that's a rundown. We don't have anything else for you, folks. Nothing else has happened. And if it has happened, we don't – oh, wait, no, something did happen. No, we're not going to do that. That'd be a spoiler. There might be somebody that listens to this show that still reads The Walking Dead comics. So never mind. We won't talk about that.
And besides, we don't really care.
No, it was just I thought some of Robert Kirkman's comments were humorous. But that being said, that's it for that. So – staring at the Bunsen burner, which is standing next to the grandfather clock here in the room, it can only mean that it's time for one thing. Mm-hmm. The Wrestling Minute. Well, Nick, we had a big wrestling weekend this past weekend. I visited you in the plains, in the woods, and in the streams of the Duke compound. And we sat down and we watched a little bit of 1998 Raw. We watched a little bit of New Japan's Best of the Super Juniors. We watched just a little bit, thankfully, of the Super Showdown in Jeddah in the, the Progressive Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And we watched New Japan Pro Wrestling Dominion. So quite a packed wrestling weekend for the hard traveling fanboys.
Absolutely. And mostly a good one. You know, we did not watch much of Super Showdown, which is good. And what we saw of it was not good. Oh. And what we saw of Dominion was very good. So good weekend all around.
Yes. I came out of the weekend impressed by the likes of Will Ospreay.
Yes.
Who had a strong weekend. We backed her in the Super Juniors tournament and his match with Dragon Lee at Dominion. Certainly, I thought the Shingo Takagi match was spectacular from Ospreay. Then you had I came away also impressed by Jay White, which may be the first time I've ever said that, Nick. But I came away impressed by Switchblade Jay White. I thought he had an excellent match with Tanahashi. And, boy, they really worked that arm.
They did work that arm, and I know that was very important to some people out there.
And that was a really good match. And then I thought, what was the other big match at Super Juniors that we watched? I can't remember.
Moxley and Juice.
Moxley and Juice was a good match.
It was.
And nice to see John Moxley, the former Dean Ambrose, having fun again, enjoying being a wrestler, which you should do if you're a wrestler. Enjoy it. On the Dominion show, I thought Taichi had his best match that I've ever seen.
Taichi
against Tomohiro Ishii.
Now, how does Hirooki Goto fit into any of this?
We didn't see him, unfortunately, at Dominion, but we did. I did think Ishii and Taichi had a phenomenal match. I mean, Ishii is just a monster, man. I love watching that guy. And I also love watching Tai Chi's manager.
Oh.
She's terrific.
Miho Abe.
Yes. And and other than that, I thought the other two singles title matches were great. Three, I guess. Ospreay and Dragon Lee, which we already talked about. Ibushi and Naito. I'm so torn on this, man, because I thought it was an amazing match, but the bumps they took in that match were so bad. Like, so stuff that, like, you know, if it was 10 years ago, I'd be marking out over online talking about how amazing it was. But now it's like, I don't really – Ibushi is too good and Naito is too good. They don't have to fall on their heads for me to like their match, you know?
Absolutely. And besides, you can't do it on that day.
And then the main event was Jericho and Okada, which I enjoyed. I thought it was a good match and had a – what I really, really liked the finish a lot because – somebody pointed this out on Twitter, and I think it's a great point. At some point, you've got to rebuild in wrestling the near fall because we've been conditioned. We're as guilty as anybody as fans have been conditioned of you don't buy a near fall unless it is a finisher. And half the time, you don't buy it if it's the first finisher. So, you know, that's just a decade plus of, you know, conditioning that usually one finisher doesn't end it. But it's got to be a finisher. You don't end major matches on roll-ups. You don't end major matches with non-finishing moves. I think you got to do these finishes once in a while to rebuild the concept of a near fall that can really get the audience, if that makes sense. I remember one of my I was thinking back on my favorite Bret Hart matches, and almost every one didn't end with the sharpshooter. So, like, the Bulldog match is the finish that we saw with Okada and Jericho. The Diesel match was the small package that catches him after playing possum. Thinking about back to the Mr. Perfect match at King of the Ring, which ends on a small package. And then there's Benoit in WCW, which did end with a sharpshooter, but off of like a superplex that normally would have been sort of a transition move. So I don't know. I like the finish a lot. I didn't think it was an amazing match, but I thought it was a really good match. Made a lot of sense, and the finish certainly did not bother me the way it has bothered some that it didn't end with a Rainmaker.
Yeah, I would mostly agree with all that. And that has been the wrestling 10 minutes.
Well, with all that said, Nick, I mean, gosh, what do we have coming the people's way in coming weeks? I think we've already told them that, actually. So let's not tell them that again.
No, let's not. Just remind you that next week we'll have a very special Off the Page on X-Men The Last Stand, where we're going to kind of do some compare and contrast and kind of settle which one's better, Last Stand or Dark Phoenix. And it's a little sad that that even has to be a legitimate question to ask at this point.
Indeed. We'll laugh. We'll cry. We'll.
You'll probably get angry.
Why will I get angry?
You are much more personally let down and invested yes. in the failure of Last Stand than I was.
That's true. That's fair to say. I was. I felt about The Last Stand the way that you probably felt about Batman Forever, which was just a colossal sense of disappointment and upset. Mm. Upset stomach and diarrhea.
Heartburn, indigestion, upset stomach, diarrhea. Yay, Pepto-Bismol.
Mm. And this is boo, The Last Stand.
And speaking of Pepto-Bismol, nobody – I don't know a bigger fan of the old pink liquid on the face of this here planet – then our good friend of the show, close personal, longtime friend, WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross, who is here this weekend, or this week, to sing us a little tune, take us back to the late 2000s in country music. He's going to sing us a little tune by Blake Shelton about lost love and finding it again. So here, once again, ladies and gentlemen, WWE Hall of Famer, Jim Ross. Jim, take it away.
I ain't got no time to waste. I'm not gonna do any pleasantries. I'm not gonna sit here. I'm not going to regale you with tales of small talk of what I've been doing in Norman, Oklahoma, what I've been doing in my new podcast with Conrad Thompson, Grillin' JR, or why you should not be hit by a train. Instead, I am going to start singing right now. She left without leaving a number. She said she needed to clear her mind. He figured that she'd gone back to Austin again. And why the hell wouldn't she, by the way? Why wouldn't you want to go back to Austin if you had the choice? Anyway, because she talked about it all the time. It was almost a year before she called him up. Three rings and an answering machine is what she got. I remember the first time I answered my new answering machine when I moved in my new house in Stamford, Connecticut, and on the other line was Stu. And I said, Stu, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. Why are you calling me? And Stu said, what about the carting up the anvil there and getting him a job there in the WWF? Nah. And I said, Stu, I am in talent relations. It's not my job right now. You need to call Bruce. Bruce, he'll get you set up. I don't like that pretty. Okay, Stu, that's fine. If you're calling about the car, I sold it. If this is Tuesday night, I'm bowling. If you've got something to sell, you are wasting your time unless that is a body part. If you're selling a body part, you need to take your time and sell some more. I'm not buying. If it's anybody else, wait for the tone. You know what to do. And P.S., if this is Austin, I still love it. Anyway, the telephone fell to the counter. She heard, but she couldn't believe. What kind of man would hang on that long? What kind of love must that be? She waited 3 days, and then she tried again. She didn't know what she'd say, but she heard three rings, which, by the way, to this point in time, I don't believe any human being has three Hall of Fame rings. But I would suggest that if anyone's going to do that, it's going to be the heartbreak kid, Shawn Michaels. Friday night, I'm at the ball game. And first thing Saturday, if it don't rain, I'm headed out to the lake and I'll be gone a weekend long. But I'll call you back when I get home on Sunday afternoon. Oh, and P.S., if this is Austin, goddamn, I still love you. Well, this time, she left her number, but not another word. When she waited by the phone on Sunday evening, and this is what he heard. He heard now. He is me. That's what I'm getting at here. Anyway, this is what I hear. This is what he heard. If you're calling about my heart, it's still yours, you son of a bitch. I should have listened to it a little bit more. Then it wouldn't have taken me so long to know where I belong, stomping a mud hole in your ass. By the way, boy, this is no machine you're talking to. Can't you tell this is Austin? And goddammit, I still love you too. Actually, I don't love nobody because you're a piece of trash.
Hard traveling fanboys.